The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UAP reality. I'm David Twitchell, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO, UAP, and abduction phenomenon.
Our guest today is Paul Blake Smith. Mr. Smith is the author of President Eisenhower's Close Encounters, just released by a Foundation Publishing. He previously authored Mo-41, the bombshell before Roswell, and Three Presidents, Two Accidents, more Mo-41, UFO crash data at opposite ends of 2016. These were the first two books ever published about the late April 1941 UFO event outside his hometown of Cape Girardeau, Missouri. Paul promoted those books as a guest on Coast to Coast AM in 2016 within Linda Moulton Howell's Earth Files report, and then more at length in January of 2017 with Sunday night host George Knapp. He was also on We Are Not Alone in 2018. The Eisenhower book is Paul's fourth nonfiction UFO book and his sixth book overall. In 2018, Paul released his well-reviewed nonfiction book, JFK and the Willard Hotel Plot, the explosive new theory of Oswald in D.C., shedding startling new light on the 1963 assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Paul has recently completed a presidential sequel out later this year, the Nixon-Gleason alien encounter. So we're happy to have him with us today. Welcome, Paul.
Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate the forum, and I hope when it's over we can answer a lot of questions. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you with us. So, if you would please recap the 1941 UFO event near Cape Girardeau, Missouri, for those unfamiliar with it.
All righty. The story really went national on Coast to Coast AM when Art Bell was alive, and he was host around the year 1999 and 2000. They got a hold of some information from a woman named Charlotte Mann, who was the granddaughter of Reverend William G. Huffman of Cape Girardeau. And Charlotte wrote down her life story on this particular subject and sent it to Ray Fowler. That's a name UFO investigators may recognize. And he brought in Leonard Stringfield and then Stanton Friedman. These are all very famous names. I'm afraid most of them are passed on. However, they came to Cape Girardeau and looked into it. And they brought along Ryan Wood, a famous author, and he runs the majesticdocuments.com site. And they really feel that the Cape Girardeau story is legit. And they even included it in a Sci-Fi Channel special back in around 2002, The Secret, The Evidence That We Are Not Alone. So the Charlotte Mann's letter is the crux of it, but I'll mention that when I talked about this story, about a UFO crash and space people, with my stepmother, she says, I recall hearing this story when I was in high school in the 1960s. And I said, oh, who told you? And what did you learn? And she says, I can't remember, but I do remember hearing this tale that a spaceship crashed in a farm field. And it turns out her father was a friend of a local newsman who was a friend of my family and was in our family home. And he may have been the one who went out to the crash site as seen by William G. Huffman. He saw at least one or two newsmen at the crash site taking photographs with big old flashbulb cameras, you know, that would blind you if you looked into them.
Right.
And taking some notes. It was should have been the bombshell story of all time. This is 6 years before Roswell. Late April 1941, we were not even at war with Japan or Europe. The Nazis were considered a grave threat. We really weren't too concerned with the Empire of Japan at the time. And apparently, Reverend Huffman said he saw, when he got to the site, an FBI man. And I thought, well, that can't be so. We didn't have an FBI office in Cape Girardeau, but I was wrong. When I researched this, I found that we had an FBI office open up in early March of 1941. We had a problem in Southeast Missouri with some sabotage and espionage from pro-Nazi agents because there was a large German contingent in the Southeast Missouri area, and a lot of them were farmers. We even had a church service, a Lutheran church service in Cape Girardeau that was conducted entirely in German. So it makes sense that the FBI would come out and start swearing people to secrecy. We were afraid Hitler would find out about this shocking event and that we wanted to keep it as top secret as and hushed as possible. So this is a big reason why the story got covered up. And it's still obscure compared to Roswell, unfairly, in my opinion. And so it makes sense what Reverend Huffman told his family when he got back from the crash later that night. In my first book, I made a mistake. I thought it happened on April 12, 1941. But in reviewing matters, I found this was not so. It was one of the days in late April. We're not entirely certain, but I wrote my publishers and they said, let's revise your 2016 book and reissue it. And so I did. I tried to correct and update it with a little more information. And that's why I hope that anyone who buys a copy will get that revised and updated edition from 2020 from Argus Publishing.
Okay, now you offer even more data concerning the crash in your second book. Now, was the second book an update or the corrections? Or
it had more information that came in and more that I uncovered. And I told the story firsthand of looking around in farm territory in Cape Girardeau to maybe see if I can find this myself. Well, I'm dissatisfied with that book, too. I need to make some corrections, some revisions, and a few updates. And I've just about got that polished up. And I hope to release a reissue of that one, Three Presidents, Two Accidents. And I know Linda Moulton Howe had me on her show and earthfiles.com to talk about it. And it's all just an amazing story. One person contacted me and said, did you hear about the second crash site? And this was after the first book came out. I said, no, what's this? He said, I don't have any corroboration. And I can't come up with hard proof, which is so prevalent in the story overall. Mm-hmm. But there was supposedly this wealthy upscale family that lived about a mile or so from the farm territory where we generally think it happened. And they said something came down in their yard and they're not sure what. And Linda Moulton Howe told me about Roswell and how there was a second crash site and investigators with the government theorized in private, of course, that an escape pod came down. And I'm thinking that may have been what came down in Cape Girardeau also. But I'm so frustrated. The house today is still a wealthy upscale area. There are signs up saying, you know, no trespassing, private property. I know a young man who tried to ask the property owners, can I bring in a metal detector? And they said no. So the family that owns it is also involved in conservative politics, and they really don't want to discuss it at all. So there's another dead end. Just trying to get some hard evidence, some real solid proof on this aging story has been like trying to nail Jell-O to a wall. But it is fascinating, and I'll certainly give you more details. I'm just curious if our audience tonight has seen this photograph of what appears to be two Cape Girardeau men holding up the alien, posing with it. Does that ring a bell?
I remember you speaking about that back in 2018 on my show. Turned out that, to be a fake.
Yeah, don't believe that photograph. Okay. That is a recreation for that sci-fi channel. They had two men dress up in attire from that era and prop up a dummy alien and take its picture. But apparently it's a very accurate recreation of what Reverend Hoffman said he saw. He was called out probably a little after sundown, maybe a little after 9 o'clock in late April, said that someone associated with the Cape Girardeau Police Department called him and asked, would you go to this crash site? Because they thought it was an airplane crash. So he said, of course I will. I'll do my Christian duty and try to comfort any victims on the ground or their families that might show up. So he went out there. They went in an unmarked car and stopped at a farm field where they could see a blaze and some sort of craft. And they walked a ways out onto the field. And sure enough, there was a round silver vehicle unlike anything he'd seen before. Not cylindrical, no wings, no props, no wheels. It was a disc, and it was busted open. And we'll get to what Reverend Huffman said he saw when he looked in there in just a minute. But he looked over, and there were no humans on the ground, no victims of any kind, except three small, identical, gray, big-headed aliens, what we call today your typical gray. Mm. I talked to a woman who said, I was 11 years old at the time of the crash. We lived on a farm not too far away, and I remember the adults coming in all excited, talking about these little space people or little spacemen in their little spaceship. She said, we did not use the term UFO or ET or flying saucer, none of that. It was just these little men that had been found. Hmm. So I think that lends authenticity to what she told me, and naturally she's passed away. And that's what makes this story so very difficult to research. It's a long time ago, over 80 years now. I found in writing my book around 2014, 15, 16, that everyone is deceased, and in many cases, their children are deceased. So unless you pass the story down in your family, it's probably pretty died out. There are occasional people who pop up and say, I remember my grandparents talking about this, if only I had listened more. And another woman said that she recalls hearing the story told matter-of-factly by her mother when she was a kid. And they didn't bat an eye or joke about it or anything. Mm-hmm. But, of course, her mother is deceased. And so, again, dead end after dead end. I can't find an old diary or a snapshot, a copy of a picture. The military came in and squashed it pretty good. And I'll give you more detail on that in just a second.
I may have misunderstood you. Did you say that the good Reverend saw a blaze?
Yeah, there was a bit of a fire going, and it was being put out by the Cape Girardeau Fire Department.
Well, what was the blaze for? I mean, you got a UFO crash.
Right.
You're not going to have a blaze.
That's part of the mystery. Was it fuel, or was it some sort of giant explosion? Apparently, according to the story, someone saw, this is like secondhand, I was told, a young man who worked on the farm saw a fireball, thought it was an airplane crash, and rushed inside and called the operator. In those days, you didn't have direct dial, and they patched through the call to the Cape Girardeau Police and Fire Department. They were located in the same building back in those days. It's now a very nice museum, but it doesn't touch upon the UFO crash. In fact, almost nothing does in Cape Girardeau today. There is no museum or site you can really go to. Mm-hmm. Well, there was some sort of blaze. How it was created, I don't know, but apparently the air in the cockpit of this disc was different, or less oxygen, because the three creatures on the ground, Reverend Huffman said, two were dead and one was just barely breathing, and they were all stretched out side by side by side. There was a rumor that someone had rushed out to the crash and pulled these bodies out and laid them out. And there was no visible injuries of any kind. They looked like they'd been punched out of a mold, as if in a factory or something. So I lend credence to what Colonel Philip Corso said when he discussed his book, The Day After Roswell, and what they felt in the Pentagon in private, that the creatures at Roswell were created in a kind of biophysics lab by very advanced creatures. They were like bio-robots. They were somewhat alive beings like you and I, mm-hmm. but they were probably programmed to do the dirty work of an advanced race. And that's why a crash would occur and the aliens would not go back for their brethren, their, you know, the bodies, and you know, go back and pick them up, because mm-hmm. they can just go back to the factory and pull out a few more, and it's nothing to them. So in Cape Girardeau, Reverend Huffman knelt next to the creature that was still just barely respirating, and he started to say some prayers, and he could look down and see that the creature had died. He stopped moving. He was completely inert. And while he was doing this, two local gentlemen picked up one of the dead bodies and propped it up with its arms held out aloft. Long, thin arms, apparently long, thin legs, big bulbous head, gray skin. There was some crinkliness about it, like almost like crinkled up aluminum foil, which might have been their skin in reaction to our oxygen-rich atmosphere that they could not breathe, apparently. And it could have been a flight suit that also reacted to Earth's atmosphere. So the photographer came along, and instead of using his big old speed graphic news camera, he pulled out a small brownie box camera and took one picture. And then he stuck the camera back in his pocket, which is most fortunate, because the military arrived in trucks and hemmed in the site and said, "We'll take every scrap of evidence, put that debris down. You didn't see this. This never happened. This is a matter of national security. You're not to discuss this with anybody." And apparently Reverend Huffman was even sworn to secrecy. He took an oath, and that it's very possible everyone was, and they were quite intimidated by these military personnel. And you might think, well, Cape Girardeau really wasn't a military base per se. But two things. Cape Girardeau was the home of a National Guard armory. And there was a young man back in 1906 who trained at that armory. His name was Harry Truman. He lived in Cape Girardeau in the summer of 1906 and trained in the city and around in the area near the Mississippi River, which is where we are located there. In 1941, Cape Girardeau boasted about 20,000 people. Today, it's double that, and it's a big college community. I went to college there. But another factor is that in Sykeston, Missouri, about 30, 35 miles south of the crash site, was an Army training program for civilian pilots to learn how to fly and become real cadets, a cadet training school, really. I wouldn't call them too much civilians. And so the brother of the Cape County Sheriff ran that aerial training program for the Army in the Air Corps, I think they called it back then. Yeah. And so all it took was just a quick phone call between the county sheriff, who showed up at the crash scene, and his brother, and to summon these people for a crash. And that's how they were able to just jump into trucks and be there on the scene.
Okay.
So quickly.
Okay. And I need to take a moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. And we're speaking with researcher and author, Mr. Paul Blake Smith. So you say that the biological entities, and yet they, you also say that they could be punched out back at the factory.
Are they? That's a theory, of course.
In theory, though, it's all theory, but in theory, would you say these are robots or clones?
I'll go with what Colonel Corso said. He called them bio-robots, almost like clones of creatures, and it did seem to need to breathe with its chest going up and down.
Well, a clone would.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I say a clone would.
Yeah. So they didn't seem to have much emotion, very tiny little dots for nostrils, just barely a slit for a mouth, no visible ears. Mm-hmm. And they had huge, big, glassy, like black eyes, like a doll. Mm-hmm. And I was intrigued by a story from, I think, the early 50s, when a scientist went to a scientific convention in Mexico City and ran into former Secretary of State George Marshall. And Marshall had worked for Truman, was quite close to Truman, and they started talking about UFOs. There'd been a UFO sighting in the area of Mexico City. And General Marshall supposedly told this scientist, we've had at least three accidents, and they are not able to breathe our atmosphere, and they incinerated within. So visibly on the outside, they seemed fine, but the oxygen just killed them. And I think that might be an accurate description of what took place in Cape Girardeau. They were outside the conditions of their ship, very set for their life to be sustained in the ship. And once it cracked open, that could have produced maybe a fire, but certainly creatures who could not breathe our atmosphere. So it was a disaster for them. And we'll never know for sure. I can tell you what has been factually claimed, and then I can speculate reasonably without getting too carried away, that these might have been dispensable to a higher race that were here scouting around. So Reverend Huffman was obviously very rattled, but before the military showed up, he did walk over to the craft and he peeked inside. And I'm thinking there were probably cars with headlights shining on the scene and people with lanterns and flashlights so they could take a peek. And he said he could see in this cracked open disc. He did not describe it as really large or really small, so I guess about mid-size would be a logical conclusion. He said there was at least one seat that would be that what we would call for a child by human standards. Mm-hmm. And there was a kind of dashboard with gauges and dials. He didn't recognize really anything too specifically. And that he saw a silver band, a silver metal band around encircling the top of the cockpit, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. And there was strange hieroglyphic writings on that silver band. He couldn't make them out. It was like nothing he'd seen before. So the story seems to hold together that the local farmer rushed out to the crashed object and thought at first it would be an airplane and tried to save the day and pulled these bodies out through this cracked opening. Whether it met with the disaster in the air through mechanical failure or pilot error or was zapped by lightning or did not crack open until it hit the ground, I don't know. We can only speculate.
So as far as physical evidence is concerned, what do they have?
Sadly, everyone was told to put down what they had in their hands, real solid proof. There is a Cape Girardeau fireman named Walter Reynolds, who was on his deathbed with cancer, according to his grandson. He took the family aside, gathered them together and said, you know that spaceship story in Cape Girardeau? Says that story was absolutely true. I was there fighting the fire for the fire department. Mm-hmm. The military came in and they caught us. They forced us to put down all the evidence, and I tried to sneak a piece into my pocket, and they caught me, and they chewed me out, and they forced me to hand over that piece, he said, and they kicked me out of the crash site, you know, for being disobedient, I guess, threw him out. So he must have been a worry to the FBI or the military that were in town associated perhaps with the National Guard Armory, citizen soldiers. So he said that he was sure he was being observed, watched around town for some time after the crash, and that his telephone was tapped. And in researching this, I found out J. Edgar Hoover and President Franklin Roosevelt, were wild about tapping people's phones. There were much looser restrictions in those days. And in the interest of national security, you could do so. And so it seems plausible that this happened. And so the evidence was taken away. But I read on a forum, national internet forum called Topics, about a man who said, my grandparents owned and farmed the land where the crash occurred. And he said they lived in Minnesota, and occasionally I heard just a little tidbit of the story, and they wouldn't tell me more. So I pieced it together as best I could, flew to Cape Girardeau, and found the farm itself. And it was still being owned at that time by a man who is now quite old, who bought it from his parents just after World War II. And he was not told, the farmer was not told about any crash on the site. But he did say something very intriguing. He said, I tried to dig a cistern in the soil. And when I did, I found these little bits of metal and I couldn't crease them. I couldn't cut them. They had strange hieroglyphic writings on them I couldn't understand. I gathered them all up and put them in my barn. And the young man writing this story on Topics, the forum, said, I tried to get the old man to tell me what he did with this eventually, and he won't tell me. And he said the barn actually burned down a few years ago. So again, dead end after dead end, enticing, right. Exciting stuff, but we just can't get our hands on solid proof.
Right. Well, we can circle back to this event, but in your book, I wanted to ask you, in your book, JFK and the Willard Hotel Plot, what new evidence concerning that awful day in history could there possibly be?
Yeah, it surfaced a few years before I wrote the book, and I was quite intrigued. A leaked document from the Secret Service about an interview with a man who worked for the government as a chauffeur for, I think, the Secretary of Agriculture, who was parked outside the Willard Hotel. This was late September 1963. He swore up and down, Lee Harvey Oswald walked out of that hotel and got into an argument with the guy about illegal parking. You know, you think you're so big with the government. And the guy was clearly a little screwy. He was a nut, and he didn't know who it was at the time. But after Kennedy was killed, the document says the man firmly identified this as Lee Oswald. And this obviously had to be covered up because the government doesn't want to admit to anything other than Lee Oswald woke up one day in Dallas in November and decided almost on a whim, I'm going to shoot the president. It certainly leads, and other clues show us, that Oswald was part of the plot, and the Willard Hotel may have been the firing site, that there was an open car motorcade scheduled for, I think, October 2nd, just days away from the Oswald sighting. It would have gone right past the Willard Hotel and the so-called Freedom Plaza, where there was a rally during the January 5th, the night before the January 6th insurrection story or whatever. I don't want to drag that into it, but I'm trying to give you the location. JFK was to be taken in an open car, and he was, an open car motorcade with Haile Selassie to welcome him to America, the Emperor of Ethiopia. And JFK was wide open. There was very little security that day in Washington, D.C., but nothing happened. And I think the reason was, in the film clip that I found of that day, there were large crowds on either side of the street and TV cameras were rolling. Newsreel film coverage was being taken. Anyone who wanted to shoot the president probably could have easily, but they would have been caught. There were cops around. They would have been recorded on camera. It wouldn't have been something they could have denied. So I think the plot was scrubbed, and Oswald went back to Texas, where he remained until Kennedy came to town in an open car motorcade. So that's a fascinating story. I tried to put the clues together. It's really chilling when you find out Abraham Lincoln visited the Willard Hotel, stayed there just before he was inaugurated. John Wilkes Booth was seen in that same hotel the day of the Lincoln assassination. Julia Grant, U.S. Grant's wife, saw this strange man glowering at her, just staring. And it turns out that Booth had known that Julia Grant and U.S. Grant were invited that night to go to Ford's Theater. She was so unnerved by this, she told her husband, and they got out of town. She said, I have a terrible premonition of doom. So they opted out of going with Lincoln to Ford's Theater. So obviously, later that April night, Booth assassinated Lincoln. And did you know JFK was in the Willard Hotel in the summer of 63? He gave a speech there to senior citizens. So the hotel may have held at one point Lincoln, Booth, Kennedy, and Oswald.
Wow. So do you think Kennedy was briefed on the UFO topic by Eisenhower?
I think that's very possible. They consulted three times in person. JFK met with Eisenhower at Camp David. They spoke a few times on the phone. They were pretty good friendly terms with each other. And then Kennedy had to fly all the way across the country and meet with Eisenhower at his golf course home in Palm Springs in private. No one was allowed in on this meeting. It was just JFK and Eisenhower. And later they came out and met the press. That would have been March of 62. And they met two more times in private to discuss matters that I don't believe have ever been disclosed. So why, if you could just pick up the phone and call Eisenhower, would you not talk to him unless it was something really explosive? You know, phones could be tapped or people could be listening in at either end of the line. You can't really send a letter. Someone might find it or, it'd be intercepted. But yeah, it was on extraterrestrial matters. I think this would be a worthy explanation of why he had to go see him in person.
Well, yes and no. I mean, he was the president-elect, correct, at the time?
No. They met a couple times just before Kennedy took office. And then after Kennedy became president, a year after January 61, he flew to Palm Springs and met with Eisenhower in private.
Okay.
And two more trips while he was out in California, he would stop specifically and huddle with Eisenhower during his term in office. JFK was president then.
Okay, he was president at the time.
Right.
Okay. So there's a lot of rumors, innuendo that Kennedy was killed because he knew about the UFO phenomenon and that it was true. And he was totally against secrecy. I mean, there's this speech where he would just condemn secrecy.
Right.
And he was allegedly about to blow the whistle on the UFO phenomenon. And of course, they did not want that to happen back then. They don't want it to happen now, but it's coming out now. It's all
I'm convinced the mafia originated the plan. They hated JFK with a passion to murder him, but they didn't want to be blamed. They didn't want to have investigated and find out they're the ones that did it. So they had intelligence contacts, and that may have been an incentive for CIA-related people like Alan Dulles, Charles Cabell, who had been fired by JFK, that Kennedy's been asking a lot of questions about UFOs and talking to his aides in private about the possibility of sharing UFO data with the Soviets. And this was considered, no, this is way off limits. We can't possibly tolerate this. So that is certainly a possibility of a factor that went into Kennedy being rubbed out, because he was willing to share this information or maybe even go public someday with the American people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure quite what to think. I think it's possible, but I'm not 100% convinced. But people had their own motives. And again, this case is so old. So many documents have been withheld from the people. And again, the government said, well, it was just a lone gunman who woke up one day and decided to make himself famous. If that's the case, release every scrap of paper, every document. There's no need to keep this hidden, you know, 60 years later.
Sure. And yet, here we are.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, who all do you theorize, and I say theorize, were involved in the plot to assassinate JFK?
And well, certainly the mafia and their intelligence contacts, they worked in some cases hand in glove. That's a fact. that the CIA would want somebody rubbed out, and they would hire mafia hitmen to do it. And they may have combined forces. I think JFK's Secret Service protection was scaled back by one man in a position of trust. I put a pseudonym in for his name in my book, but I go into 10 different specific explanations how this security was stripped. You know, there was no security around his car from the sides or in front when he went through Dallas. Now, remember, Dallas was considered a very dangerous town. Everyone knew that there was a lot of strife and political extremists and threats. And so you would think they would have protected JFK with a ring of steel, really surround his car, or maybe even let him go out in a motorcade in the first place. Instead, they left him wide open.
Yeah. Yeah. That always amazed me, too.
So, all it took was one guy in a position of power to say, we're going to scale back the police motorcycles. You're to ride behind the car, never pass the back wheel of the car. Don't get anywhere near the president and don't ride in front of the car. There was a huge open space with no security, no sheriff's car or military or cops. There was no police personnel on the ground in Dealey Plaza in the area where he was shot. It's awfully suspicious.
What about Ruby? Where does Ruby figure
in? Well, Ruby was in very clearly a mafia associate. And I watched an interview with, remember, Morton Downey Jr. had his own TV show?
Yeah.
Morton said he interviewed Dr. Arthur Ochsner of the New Orleans Ochsner Institute. It was a cancer research center. And he said, Ochsner told me that Jack Ruby came in the summer of 63 and they diagnosed him with terminal cancer. Mm-hmm. So this would explain why Ruby would risk everything to get in there and shoot Oswald, even if he was arrested. He's going to die anyway. And that's exactly what happened. He died of cancer a few years later in prison. So Ruby gave a number of different explanations as to why he shot Oswald. I didn't like the smirk on his face. I wanted to be a hero. I wanted to show that Jews have guts. I wanted to spare Jackie Kennedy the agony of a trial. He made up all kinds of excuses. If there was really just, you know, one motive, he should have stuck with that instead of making up all sorts of different excuses for what he did. He knew that the mafia would attack people in his family if he didn't keep his mouth shut. And, you know, there is a film clip of Ruby sitting in a courtroom and saying, you know, there was a conspiracy. It goes very high up. You can watch that like on YouTube or something. He did admit some things, knew he was going to die anyway. But I think Oswald was part of the plot and that he fired loudly to get everyone's attention to start things off. But the shots came from in front. Dallas doctors and nurses said we were treating a small entry wound. Here in the neck, a small bullet wound about the size of a pencil eraser, and then one that entered the president's forehead and blew out the back of his head about the size of a softball. That's an exit wound. He was shot from in front. No question about it.
Had to be. Anybody that buys that he was shot in the back of the head and the back of the head blew off doesn't understand ballistics. So anyway...
And you can see the film clip of JFK being rocked backwards and then over to the side after the fatal shot. You know, he had his head down. He was gagging on this neck wound, this throat wound. And suddenly this terrible shot came from in front and blew out the back of his head. And, you know, really quickly, Jackie Kennedy gave some testimony that was cut out of the Warren Commission and was leaked some years later. That she said she went to the back of the limousine because she saw a big piece of the president's skull back there.
Yeah.
She grabs it and returns to her seat and tries to put his head together. That's what she testified. She was trying to put the back of his head together. So, you know, that had to be cut out of the Warren report.
she was in shock at the time. And I need to take one more break just to remind our listeners that, you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. And we're speaking with researcher and author, Mr. Paul Blake Smith. So Let's take some time to examine your latest upcoming book, the Nixon-Gleason Alien Encounter.
Right.
I've heard about this alleged incident from many sources before, and it prompts many questions and much skepticism. But first, let's hear about the Nixon-Gleason Alien Encounter from you.
Well, we'll remember that Nixon was Dwight Eisenhower's vice president, and I wrote an extensive book, President Eisenhower's Close Encounters, where I pinned down the date of what I feel was a genuine close encounter, that Eisenhower went to Palm Springs for a golf vacation and used that as an excuse to go out to Edwards Air Force Base on Friday night, February 19th, 1954, and meet with some friendly aliens who spoke English and were concerned with our nuclear bomb test detonation program. So 19 years later, to the day, Monday night, February 19th, 1973, Nixon met up with Jackie Gleason that afternoon on national television, I believe. It was certainly recorded by the press that Nixon dropped by Jackie's Pro-Am golf tournament, spoke with Jackie. They posed for pictures and chatted, and Nixon had arrived that day by helicopter. There was a landing pad not far from Jackie's home on the golf course, the Inverary course in Lauderhill, Florida, right outside Miami. So Jackie came home later that night after he'd been missing that evening, and he was ashen, shook up terribly, trembling, and really upset. He was starting to smoke and drink more than usual, which was considerable, for old.
How is that possible?
Yeah, really. Jackie liked to do that in the first place, but his wife said, Beverly Gleason, said in an article and in an interview many years later, she stuck by her story that he was just traumatized by the sight of something. He said Nixon took him to the airbase, Homestead Air Base, just south of Miami, and that they went on a little tour, and that Nixon showed Gleason four small dead alien bodies. They had kind of big ears. They were only like two and a half feet. They were like almost little elves. And in my research, I found out that description matches exactly the Kentucky UFO, I think it was like Hopkinsville or something like that, event where a farm family felt they were under siege by these little elf-like aliens with pointy ears.
Right.
And they opened fire on them back then. And that description matches exactly what Gleason told his wife that he saw at this airbase, only they were four dead bodies he saw for himself. Now, why would Richard Nixon risk national security codes to show a civilian with no qualifications for being there and Jackie Gleason this national secret? It turns out Gleason had been telling people for years on a radio program in New York City, I'll offer first $500,000, then he upped it to $1 million to anyone who can show me hard proof of extraterrestrial visitation. He wants indisputable proof. And that was not fulfilled, but I think Richard Nixon took him up on this. Nixon was caught in a bind. His Watergate burglars had been caught and they were going on trial and they needed money. E. Howard Hunt in particular was pressuring or blackmailing the president. I need money for my family and for legal fees. And the other burglars did too. And Nixon can be caught or heard on tape from his Oval Office bugging system talking about, where are we going to get this money? We've got to get this damn hush money to shut up the burglars. And then a few weeks, just a couple of weeks after the Gleason encounter, February 19th, 1973, Nixon says, oh, I know where we can get that. That'll be no problem to get that money. I think, I'm theorizing logically, that Nixon decided to show Jackie the goods to get that $1 million untraceable, tax-free, under-the-table donation. And Jackie was a big spender. He made millions every year. It was nothing to him to probably write out a check or have a check cashed and the cash funneled to someone like Herb Kalmbach. Kalmbach was a lawyer for Nixon who distributed the cash, and he just happened to have done some business with Gleason and the Honeymooners episode some years before. So it holds together. And I put that into my book, and I tried to cram in as many facts and exciting tidbits of information that Beverly Gleason's story seems to hold true, that it might well be something we can put our faith in even today.
And is that all Beverly Gleason said was the mention of how ashen he was? And
yeah, she said Jackie came home and was at times giddy with excitement, that I got to see this and no one else did, that I was privileged to hard proof that we are being visited. And then he would turn, become angry. And this went on for days, she said, that how can the government keep this secret and make people who think they've seen UFOs or ETs look like idiots? He was furious at his government, his own government, even the Nixon administration going along with this, that there is ample evidence that we're being visited, that there's indisputable proof. The government has it, but they're denying it, and they lie about this, and they might undertake a campaign to make a witness look like a fool. So Jackie would teeter back and forth between excitement and anger for days, and he didn't work in movies for a few years after this episode, that he was so traumatized. So Beverly said that it all really happened close to midnight. Jackie came home and slumped in a chair, started smoking and drinking and telling her this story, when all he had to do was say, you know, well, I was out with the boys having a few. And he never said anything like that. And that many years later, people approached Jackie and said, what about this story? And he refused to deny it. He didn't say, oh, this is nonsense, my ex-wife is making this up. He just said, I don't want to talk about it. So that also lends more credence that something like this really did happen. And was it a coincidence that it was on the 19th anniversary to the day at an Air Force base, just like Eisenhower, that Nixon went to Homestead and saw the proof late at night under the guise of being in Florida on a golf vacation, just like his boss Eisenhower did 19 years earlier?
Okay, but the story, as it told to me, or as I recall it anyway, is that Nixon and Gleason were alone in the car. Nixon was driving. Is that?
I've heard that story, and I do not believe it is true.
Yeah, I was listening.
Yeah, that was way too far for Nixon to drive alone in the dark at night and make it pull together timeline-wise. This story, I think, is a canard. I believe Nixon sent a helicopter to land at the pad for Gleason that night to fly him directly. Would have been much quicker. Nixon had arrived there earlier in the day by helicopter. They could have both been on that flight and gone to Homestead in maybe half an hour and returned Jackie that night without the use of a car whatsoever. The idea that Nixon drove a car all by himself in the middle of traffic for like 45, 50 minutes just to get from Key Biscayne to Gleason's house, that's simply not plausible at all.
Okay, now, but was Gleason and Nixon alone, whether they were in a car or in a helicopter or a plane, were they alone?
At the base, they Jackie said he had a military escort, that Nixon was there, and Nixon showed him these things, didn't want to answer a lot of questions, apparently. And that when it was all over, Jackie was allowed to leave the base. He did not apparently leave with Nixon. So I believe they probably helicoptered him right back to Inverary, where the president's pilot had touched down and landed, knew the coordinates quite well from earlier that very afternoon. So were Nixon and Gleason alone, possibly with the bodies themselves? It was said to have been in a kind of lab, maybe a medical lab on the airbase. Jackie told Beverly it was across the base. They had to be driven over there and with a military escort. And then there was an armed guard at the door to the building that they went in. Some versions of the story I've heard say there was an actual hangar and a silver spacecraft inside. One source claimed that the craft had to be tethered down because it was able to move up into the air. And that's a pretty interesting detail, but I have no corroboration on that one.
Yeah, it would seem that even though Nixon was president at the time, he would have to have a need to know before the guards would allow him entry, especially when accompanied by a civilian.
Right.
How do you think he managed that?
He was commander in chief of all armed forces. He was the top dog in the country. LBJ had died just weeks before. Truman was dead. J. Edgar Hoover was dead. Alan Dulles was dead. All the big shots from the 60s who probably kept the lid on the story were dead. Eisenhower died in 69. So Nixon probably felt extremely strong and unchallenged. He just won re-election the previous November in the biggest landslide in American history. So he knew he could do any darn thing he wanted to do.
Even when Nixon was about to give his resignation speech, he said to his bodyguard, leave the room. I want to be alone with the cameraman. And the man said, I'm sorry, sir, I can't do that. No, I want you to leave. I'm sorry, sir, I can't do that. He refused to leave the room.
By then, Nixon was thought to be a little unstable, having possibly taken pills, and he was drinking too much. And I think they kept a pretty good close eye on him by August of 74 to make sure he doesn't do anything too crazy.
Well, he had a cameraman in the room. So
yeah, he had his photographer, Ollie. He ordered Ollie out of the room. No more pictures, you know. Tell Ollie to leave now. But he was an extremely bright man and cunning. He was able to balance the Vietnam War, the Cold War, relations with China, relations with Russia. He had a lot on his plate, a lot of pressure on him. And he was a bit of a loner, like Jackie. He perspired a lot, liked to play golf, just like Jackie. They became friends in the 60s and played golf together in the Key Biscayne and Miami area. Jackie and Nixon played golf just before the Apollo moon landing in July of 69. So I think they developed a pretty close relationship. Where he could feel like he could confide in Jackie and Jackie would keep his mouth shut, which he promptly violated once he got home. And it reminds me of Reverend Huffman. I was telling you the story. Reverend Huffman in Cape Girardeau was sworn to secrecy, and he kind of violated that oath as soon as he got home. His family was very concerned because he too was a little ashen and shook up. And he had to tell his family, the Huffman family, that night. Well, you know, that phone call that came in and I went out in a car, we thought it was a plane crash at first. He said that was no plane crash. That was a craft with these three extraterrestrial beings. I'm sure he did not use that term. No. It had to have been unnerving. And so the excitement of the moment and telling your wife where you've been, I think Reverend Huffman and Jackie Gleason both blurted out the truth and then kept their mouths shut probably for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I can imagine after such an epiphany, you got to tell someone, right?
Right. And in 1941, we had no E.T. movie or UFOs or television shows or even really comic books. We had Buck Rogers as a comic strip about someone flying around in space, but that was about it. No one talked about such matters. It was not mainstream at all to even have the term flying saucers. That didn't come around until 1947.
Right.
Can you imagine the shock at seeing such a thing? If you were not braced up whatsoever back in April of 41, you probably would have keeled over it. Somebody did, I'm sure.
Well, I remember my sighting with my family, and can you imagine the shock? You know, when I was 14, my parents didn't know anything about UFOs or what have you. And there it was right in front of us. So we, you know.
I'll admit I've never seen a UFO or an ET. Yeah. I've had people come up and tell me their own personal stories, including a 95-year-old woman, very conservative, lived across the hall from me. She said when she was a little girl, she lived on a farm in Alabama, and she and her father were walking across a field, and there was a landed ship in the distance. Your typical round craft, she said. And she said, I want to go closer. And her daddy told her, no, you just stay here with me. Let them do whatever they got to do. And so we watched from a distance, and then we went home. I think she said it took off or something like that. And in talking to a gentleman here in Springfield, Missouri, he said, I saw this round silver disc go over my neighborhood while I was riding a bike, and other neighbors stopped what they were doing to stare up at this thing. And it was obviously not from this world. He said he was like 14 at the time, but I've never seen anything of the sort. So I remain open-minded, but I come from a bit of a skeptical or cynical family, so I don't believe everything I'm told or read, but I think we can put some faith in the Cape Girardeau story, the Eisenhower story, and the Nixon story. They're utterly fascinating. I hope folks will get a copy of my books and judge for themselves.
So where can people go to, what's your website, and go to check out your work?
I have a website called mo41.info, mo41.info, or you can just go to Amazon and look up my books under Paul Blake Smith, or go to aargusbooks.com. Or my Eisenhower book came out from Foundations Books, based out of Mississippi, and they'll be handling my Nixon one, Nixon Gleason Alien Encounter, later this year. And I'm working on research on Ronald Reagan, if I can make it a trilogy. There's already been a couple books on that, and I'd like to gather more information. We'll see if I can make a full-length book that has something new to tell and something that will capture the attention of people who are into this story without getting too crazy. I'll add that we might be able to see the Eisenhower story on the big screen someday. My agent is in talks with some production people from Hollywood. So keep your fingers crossed there.
Oh, when you say later this year, this book is coming out, you have
The Nixon book will be out later this year. The Eisenhower book came out in November 2020.
Right. Okay. So do you have a date in mind when this release in 22 will be?
No, but we're hoping to get it done by the fall gift giving season, you know, Christmas and such. And as I discuss the project itself, the book, the incident, that'll take us up to February 19th of 2023, the 50th anniversary of the Nixon-Gleason encounter, and much further back for the Eisenhower story. So it'll all kind of fit together if I'm patient. My editors and I are still polishing it up here in July. I keep gathering information on Ronald Reagan. And if anyone has anything novel or interesting that I haven't heard, well, I guess you wouldn't know if I've heard or not, but I would appreciate, hearing about it, though.
Yeah, that's like me, like anybody that follows this UFO phenomenon. You see things on television, documentaries, and you say, well, I've seen so much of it. Why should I watch this? But you just never know. Never know what you might learn new.
Yeah.
Saying? So
I thought I'd give out a shout out, if I have a quick minute here, to the late Bruce Weideman. That name might be familiar to UFO people. He was based out of St. Louis. He interviewed me last fall, and he has passed away a few weeks ago from cancer. And he was a real good guy. He was utterly fascinated. He knew a lot of people in the UFO research community. And I give a big salute to Bruce. Such a fine gentleman he was.
Well, thank you.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage and scroll down to We Are Not Alone and click on the headline, which will take you to where you can find my website with all the archived shows. Please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.